You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. The story of Jewish resistance to Nazi infiltration, which we'll hear about tonight, happened not in Warsaw or Berlin in the 30s, but in our very own city. In fact, some of the scenes in Steve Ross's new true life thriller, Hitler in Los Angeles, How Jews Foiled Nazi Plots Against Hollywood in America, took place just blocks from Central Library. And in this until now untold story, there's a fascinating cast of characters, villains, including the man termed the most charming Nazi in Los Angeles, and unlikely real-life heroes, including Leon Lewis, the man the Nazis called the most dangerous Jew in Los Angeles. We learn why Los Angeles, with its long history of anti-Semitism and right-wing extremism, was the logical place for Nazis to plan their assault on the United States. And this is a tale chronicled by a writer with a personal connection to this history who wields the skills of both a spellbinding novelist and a master historian. And as we watch neo-Nazis on the march in our own country in 2017, it's a story that also reminds us how hate groups can move from the margin to the center, and how people of goodwill must take risks and use their smarts and their courage to preserve our democracy. Stephen J. Ross is professor of history at USC and director of the Kasdan Institute for the Study of the Jewish Role in American Life. He's spoken at Aloud for his last book, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics, which won an Academy of Motion Pictures Film Scholars Award. He's also the author of several other books, including Working Class Hollywood, Silent Film, and The Shaping of Class in America. Steve is in conversation tonight with writer Rob Eshman, until very recently the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Jewish Journal. Both Rob and the Jewish Journal have won numerous local and national awards for writing, design, and community leadership. Rob is a founding board member of the Daniel Pearl Journalism Institute. We're delighted to welcome him to Aloud for the first time. Please welcome Steve Ross and Rob Eshman. Thank you.
Aloud for having us here, and thank you, Steve, for writing this book, which I loved.
Thanks.
I'm not going to be objective here. So let's jump into it. We are essentially at ground zero, if you look at that map.
Right.
All around us were meeting places where the Nazis set up headquarters, ate, went to their beer halls, not even an Uber right away, or an Uber Alles right away. So maybe you could start, for people who didn't read the book, to kind of give us a sense of the landscape of Nazi Los Angeles in the 30s.
Right. Well, just to give you the quick background, Adolf Hitler becomes Reich Chancellor of Germany in January 1933. And the minute he does, he announces he's basically going to implement his anti-Semitic policies. That everyone who thought, oh, he was just being over the top to get elected, and once in office, he's going to calm down. Well, they were wrong. He followed through on everything he promised. Jews, in the meantime, one of the things I discovered, I had been under the illusion that, you know, like many Jews, hadn't done much to stop him. But in fact, they did. But the Jews had a divided strategy between the American Jewish Congress and the American Jewish Committee. One group, the committee, basically wanted to get in Hitler's face, and Samuel Untermeyer, a Jewish attorney in New York, launched an international boycott of all German products until Hitler stopped persecuting Jews and other minorities, not just Jews. And they hoped to bring pressure on the very fragile German economy. The American Jewish Congress said, no, that's going to backfire. that if you get in Hitler's face, he's going to double down and be even worse. And what we need to do is contact religious leaders in Germany and get them to work behind the scenes. Well, neither strategy worked. And in July 27th, 1933, at the Altheidelberg, not far from here, a little further from downtown, that's now a America's Motel, something like this, Nazis held their first open meeting. And in it, they announced they wanted to recruit and that their goal was to rid the country of communists and Jews. Within a few days of that, Leon Lewis, whose office was just a few blocks from here, 626 West 7th Street, Jewish Central, you see the Magen David up there. And this just to me, no matter what I say today, just think, look at this map. Imagine being a Jew, and this is what you are surrounded by. And Leon Lewis says, enough talk, we need action now. He was the founding executive secretary of the Anti-Defamation League in 1913, went off to war and fought, rose up from being an enlisted private to a captain by the time he left, and then went back to the ADL, told them they needed to monitor anti-Semitism in Europe, so he got a second assignment to be the founding executive secretary of the ADL's international division. But eventually he was also working with the moguls in Hollywood, monitoring images, anti-Semitic images in American film. Around 1930-31, he moves to Los Angeles and sets up his law practice here. But the minute the Nazis hold their open meeting, he says it's time to act. Someone has to stand up before it's too late. And he goes right down, for those of you who were crawling along the 10, when you're crawling along and if you're coming towards downtown on the right side before you hit it, on Figueroa, you see Bob Hope Patriotic Hall, right? Sound familiar? Well, that was built by the county in 1926 to house veterans groups. And he went to his friends and the disabled American veterans, and he recruited 4 World War I veterans and their wives who'd agreed to go undercover and join every Nazi and fascist group in Los Angeles and report back to him on a daily basis. And so I was fortunate enough that there are over 200 boxes of the spy reports at Cal State Northridge, and that's what I went through to get the story. And what's interesting is all but one of his major spies are Christians. And they knew, you know, I was asked by my editor, well, why would they work for him if he's a Jew? And the answer is they knew he was Jewish, but they never considered they were working for a Jew. As far as they were concerned, these were all fellow veterans. And whether they were Jewish American, Catholic American, Black American, Protestant American, everything before that hyphen is an adjective. And what they have in common is the noun that they are American. And true Americans do not let another American kill or threaten an American because of their race or religion. And so they went to work for him. And over the years, he had to turn over a number of spies because they would testify. And the moment they testified, they were burned, so they couldn't. But it is amazing story of courage.
But if you look at this map and you see all those swastikas, and we're not even talking about the Christian militia groups, which is a whole other group, but and they were so public. I mean, now it's hard to believe that you could have a rally, an anti-Jewish rally, and in public like that. So it must have been a different world, an atmosphere of more common anti-Semitism.
Yes, well, this was for Hitler and Goebbels. L.A. was the center of America, not New York, which they referred to as Jew York, for several reasons. First of all, the mayor of New York, Fiorello LaGuardia, was half Jewish, for those of you who don't know. His mother was Jewish, so if you're a Reform Jew and not living in Israel, he's Jewish.
Luckily, he's Jewish anyway.
He made sure that the ports of New York were closely guarded. And so the Nazis were no fools. They may have been villains, but they weren't fools. So they were sending most of their propaganda, their money, and their spies through the port of L.A., either in L.A. or San Pedro, because they knew those ports weren't, two things, the ports weren't guarded, and Los Angeles has a long history of, well, Los Angeles and Southern California, of anti-Semitism, racism. This is where the right-wing movement really...
So what happens when Lewis goes to the police?
So within a few weeks of their starting the spy operation, these four veterans go in, and the Nazis want them because they are trying to duplicate Hitler's strategy of the 20s, where Hitler recruited his brown shirts were mainly World War I veterans who were really angry at the government. They had gone, and it's understandable, you fight for your country. Whenever you go off to war, everyone's very patriotic to send you to war. But when you come back, they kind of forget about you. And so the Nazis here thought, we're going to get World War I veterans, because in March 1933, when Roosevelt took over the White House, one of the first things he did with Congress, because the economy was so bad, is they cut military benefits as part of the Economy Act. They made cuts in everything. But they cut veteran benefits from $80 to $100 down to $20. And the idea was, if we can recruit Americans, because the people Lewis brought in were all officers, and in one case, William Connolly was the national head of the disabled American veterans, touring the country attacking Roosevelt for being so callous towards the vets. And they thought, if we bring in these guys, they in turn will get other Americans, and they can train them into a military cadre. They were raising an army in downtown Los Angeles. That was what they were trying to do.
And what
did
they plan to do with this army? Like, what were the real threats?
Well, the first thing they did is they discovered this man, Dietrich Gefgen, who had fled Germany in the 20s after shooting and killing several communists who were probably Jewish as well. And he went to San Francisco and joined the National Guard. There was no background check then. And he came down to L.A. with the blueprints for the National Guard Armory, where all the weapons were stored, all the ammunition was stored. He was also working with Silver Shirts, which were the American Nazis. The Hitler had the brown shirts, Mussolini had the black shirts, and here in America, William Dudley Pelley started the Silver Shirts. They discovered that Gefgen wanted the four guys who were recruited to get the plans for the L.A. Armory, and he told them that we are going to have an uprising on the same day and take over the armories in San Francisco, L.A., and San Diego. And any of the soldiers there who are willing to join them, they would gladly welcome in, and anyone who was going to resist them, they would shoot on the spot. And when Leon Lewis got the reports, he went to the chief of police, James Two Gun Davis, known as Two Gun.
You have a picture of him, right?
Yes. Okay. We can, do we want to see the picture?
Yeah, Two Gun Davis. You got to see a picture
okay.
of Two Gun Davis.
So here is just, this is downtown Broadway Street. This is flying. This is not just a day. That Nazi flag is flying permanently.
So this is Broadway and what, since we're here?
I'm not sure what the cross streets okay. are. That's Leon Lewis, the spy master.
And how old was he at the time?
He would be, so 1888, 30. He'd be 30 years old here.
Wow.
His first recruit was John Schmidt, who was German-born, the son of a German general. His brother was, I forget, either a general or a colonel, and he had been in the German army, but left, he was a cadet, left when he was 16, came to America and fought with General Pershing in Mexico, and then fought in World War I for the Allies. So imagine Leon Lewis, his first recruit, he is asking a German Christian coming from a distinguished German military family to spy on fellow Germans on behalf of Jews. This was the Aryan bookstore downtown. The man on the left, the light color, will become the head of the Friends of New Germany, that becomes the German-American Bund, and that is Hermann Schwinn, and I don't know who's standing next to him, but that was their bookstore where they had all the latest German newspapers, magazines, books, pamphlets many of which they brought in illegally, but no one shut them down. And finally, he was known as Two Guns because he could shoot with either hand, and he won, he liked to brag that he won the National Police Shooting Competition right-handed and then won it left-handed. And it was James Davis who coined the phrase in L.A., shoot first, ask questions later. So Leon Lewis goes in to talk to Two Guns and tells him about this plot. And Davis stops him about 2 minutes into it because he wrote a long memo describing this. Says, stop, you don't get it. Hitler's doing the right thing. Hitler is doing what he had to do to protect his country from the Jews who are ruining the economy. And in fact, the real enemies and villains in Los Angeles are not the Nazis, they're the people, those communists in Boyle Heights. And he proceeded to basically tell them, as far as he was concerned, every communist was a Jew, and every Jew was a communist. And you have to know, in the 1920s, when the DA raided the police and sheriff, when they raided Ku Klux Klan headquarters, they found literally hundreds of people from police and sheriff's department who belonged to the Klan. And I discovered in the course of the research that throughout the 40s, up through the end of the war, there were many people both in the LAPD and the sheriff's department who were either active members of the Silver Shirts or one of the fascist organizations, or were strong supporters of them.
The other plot you talk about is a murder plot.
Many murder plots,
right,
yeah.
But the one to round up Hollywood actors and...
Right, there were two big plots that came down. One in 1935, and that was by a man named Ingram Hughes, who had issued a proclamation. Imagine waking up in September 1935 to your Sunday LA Times, and you open it up, and there inserted is a document called the Proclamation that Ingram Hughes, who had worked as a linotype person at the LA Times and had friends there, they had inserted this proclamation inside secretly. And the proclamation basically, this was nothing compared to that, because it ended by calling for the final solution to the Jewish problems through means that are not obtainable through legislation. And what he had planned to do, working with a number of fellow fascists and Hermann Schwinn and his Nazi cohort, they were going to hang 20 Hollywood Jews. Not just the Hollywood Jews, but a number of L.A. Jewish political leaders. And among the Hollywood Jews, Busby Berkeley, who I didn't know was Jewish until I traced this down. And Ingram Hughes had said to one of Leon Lewis's spies, who was his chief assistant, that Busby Berkeley is going to look good dangling at the end of a rope. And just to show their contempt for the Jewish scum of America, once these 20 men were dead, hanging, they were to go by with machine guns and riddle the bodies. And you said to Chuck Slocum, he said, on this day that we do this, it's going to start pogroms throughout all of America, and it's going to start a mass slaughtering of Jews in every major American city. And that never happened, mainly because they knew from the beginning. As Louise said, Leon Lewis was dubbed the most dangerous Jew in Los Angeles. And they knew that Leon Lewis had secret agents inside all their organizations. They just didn't know who it was. And Hughes had arranged with Nazis and some other fascists for these killings. But then they got nervous because they knew there was a spy. And he turned to Chuck Slocum and said, but I'm too smart for those Jews. They're never going to catch me. But in the end, I mean, Slocum tells Lewis, of course, and Ingram Hughes decides, well, we're going to postpone this until we figure out who the spy is. Well, they never did, so that plot got postponed permanently. And then a year later, we have... let me go to Chuck Slocum. That's Chuck Slocum. Every one of these spies had a code name. And it took me a while to figure out who was who. And at the back of my book, there's an appendix, because I couldn't, even when I was writing it, sometimes I had to look at my own appendix, because there's so many names. There's so many spies, and there's so many Nazis, and so many fascists. But in 1937, here we go, on the left, sitting, who looked, the man all the way on the left who looks bigger, is Leopold McLaughlin, who is much bigger. He's about 6'8". He was the world's jiu-jitsu champion. He was the brother for movie files of Victor McLaughlin, the Oscar winner. But the two brothers didn't, there were eight brothers altogether, seven or eight. And they hated Leopold. They all hated him because he was a con man. And so Leopold, to distinguish himself from his brother, changed the spelling of his last name to L-A-N as opposed to L-E-N. But he comes in, and again, with Chuck Slocum and two of the leading Silver Shirt leaders in L.A., they're going to blow up the homes of 24 Hollywood figures, Louis B. Mayer, Samuel Goldwyn, people like this, plus two actors who were too friendly to Jews, Charlie Chaplin and James Cagney. And again, they thought this was going to start a series of pogroms throughout America. And here we have Bishop Bell, the man in the middle, and in the back row, I don't know, we can see, standing in the back, you have a woman with her arms crossed, and right behind her is one of the sheriffs, Frank Gompert, who, when the plot was foiled, Leon Lewis decided not, mainly foiled because of Chuck Slocum again, and Leon Lewis decided not to give the press the full story because he was playing the long game. Because the full story would have talked about how people in the sheriff and police department were actually part of this plot, and as well as naval intelligence bungling much of what was going on. And he figured, if I play the long game and don't embarrass them and expose them, they'll be more likely to listen to me when I really need them.
I guess the question that comes into my mind, and that as I was reading this book, how come we didn't know this? I mean, this was such a huge part of LA history. How did you find it?
Well, there are two reasons. Let's start with the main reason. Leon Lewis had an assistant, associate spy master, Joe Roos. Two of them worked together. They operated on an absolute need-to-know basis. So that even going through, it took me a long time to figure out even how to go through the spy reports, because they made it purposefully difficult to figure out who was who in case anyone broke into their offices. They went to their deathbeds, never telling their children what they were doing and never revealing the name of any of their operatives. So that I was looking at a recording Joe Roos did towards the end of his life with the Shoah Foundation. And at one point, the interviewer says to him, you know, tell me about Neil Ness, who is one of the two ace spies. And Roos literally jumps out of his seat and is so upset. How do you know that name? How do you know that name? Well, Ness had testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1939, so he was known and you could find his testimony. Roos had forgotten that, but three of their spies died very suspicious deaths. The Nazis had sworn, and this I found over and over again, the Nazis swore that if they found out any of Lewis's people, who they were dead men. They would kill them. And as I say, three spies died, and I'm convinced two of them were killed by the Nazis and fascists. One of them I think was, but I'm not as sure. And I think they felt that these people, the American government, never rounded them up in the end. They took a few people. The real horror story here is for anyone who says Jews didn't do enough to stop fascism and Nazism in America and to pressure our government to do more, just tell them, why didn't the government do more to stop Nazis and fascists in America? The FBI, if it was up to me, my editor made me cut this out because she said, you have such a Jones against J. Edgar Hoover. No one's going to believe you. But J. Edgar Hoover is the villain. He is a villain. And I am convinced, I don't have the smoking gun, but he's an anti-Semite. He is putting all his energy into following Reds in America and Hollywood actors, right? Hollywood actors are threatening Jews. Hollywood actors are threatening to blow up our country.
It was so funny to me that, not that anti-Semites have to make sense, but on the one hand, they're accusing the Jews of being the communists. On the other hand, the Jews are running world capitalism. 19 of the 25 richest people in the country at that time were studio moguls.
Logic never made its way into the anti-Semitic mind. But just to give you a sense that so that Ross isn't just saying this, he does have a Jones against him. Despite from 1940 on, the local FBI says, you need to put Herman Schwinn under surveillance. He is the head of the Bund in L.A. He's also the Gauleiter, which is the head of the entire western region of the German-American Bund. And he's the number two Nazi in America after Fitz Kuhn, who's in New York and the leader of the national leader as well as the New York Bund. Hoover finally agrees to put Herman Schwinn under surveillance November 15th, 1941. You all remember what happens 3 weeks later? Pearl Harbor. A little late to put the leading Nazi, but you can put all these actors under surveillance for a decade, but you don't put the leading Nazi in Los Angeles under surveillance until 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor.
There's a myth, too, that the Jewish studio heads collaborated or went along with the Nazis. I don't know if it's a myth, but that was another historian came out with a book about that. You have a very different story, how Leon Lewis got his funding.
Right. Leon Lewis. Leon Lewis, when I'm writing this, I'm also thinking, do I want to encourage people to be vigilantes? Because that could be one implication. He's running a citizen spy group. He's not authorized by the government. It would be as though any one of you, would organize your own spy operation.
He was actually doing private recordings of people in their hotel rooms.
That's right. They were recording this stuff. They were doing a lot of illegal activities. But he always thought that this is going to be a short-term thing. I'm a lawyer. I'm going to start this. I'm going to gather the evidence from my four spies, and I'm going to turn it over to the police sheriff and the FBI, and then they're going to take it over. But when he goes to the police sheriff and the FBI, they tell him, we're not interested. And at that point, he has no more money because he's basically given all his law practice up to run the spy ring. He's paying his spies a very modest stipend because many of them have, again, gone from getting $80 to $100 a month to $20 or maybe nothing at all. So he gives them very modest expense money. And so he turns to the moguls, and on March 1934 at Hillcrest, imagine 40 limousines pull up, dropping off 40 of the most powerful
Hollywood... Hillcrest Country Club. Not everybody's been there.
Right.
Right.
It's the country club. Sometimes I say Hillside, and no, that's not where.
That's after Hillcrest.
That's after Hillcrest. That's where you go to retire. So they pull up, and as I thought to myself, this is the only time in 5,000 years that Jews have kept a secret. Because they pull up, imagine, and they're all wondering, because they've been told by Mendel Silberberg, who is the most powerful entertainment attorney in America. He's the lawyer. He's really the first great entertainment attorney. He represents most of the studios. He represents personally the studio heads and many of the major actors in the city. He's also considered one of the five Republican kingmakers. That is, he's the guy who goes into the back rooms at the GOP conventions and decides who's going to be nominated president. So when Mendel Silberberg tells you to show up, you show up. So they show up, they go into the club room, a private room, and around the 40 seats are the Silver Legion and Silver Ranger publications, all of which are incredibly anti-Semitic, and Lewis has picked the ones that are going after the Jews with the bulbous noses and the poster we saw before. This is one of the posters he was showing the moguls.
Can you all read this? Buy Gentile, employ Gentile, vote Gentile. Young Gentile girls are raped by Jewish producers, directors, and casting directors.
Harvey Weinstein is not new.
It's mostly inaccurate.
Right. And on the other hand, Leon Lewis knew who these men were. He knew they were hardscrabble men from tough backgrounds, and that simply their Jewish loyalty wasn't going to be enough. So he said, I'm going to frighten them into generosity. And he begins to tell them about what's going on, and he tells them something that none of them knew, which is the studio heads were all looking at above-the-line personnel. That is, they were interested in their writers, their producers, their directors, and the stars. In the meantime, his agents had found that below the line, the studio craft workers, who were 80 to 90% of the employees of studios, were being, every Jewish below-the-line person was being thrown out of the studios. That the silver shirts had taken over, and that foremen who belonged to the silver shirts were coming in and firing them. So Paramount had reached, quote, 100% Aryan purity. MGM, the, you know, in many ways the most Jewish of the studios, along with Warner Brothers, MGM, they're firing, there's only one or two Jews left. And he's, and they're like blown away. The Nazis are in our studio. And then he proceeds to tell them and the plots to take over armories. And in fact, they're plotting to kill you guys too. And he walks out that evening with something like, in today's dollars, $400,000. And the moguls fund the operation. So the book that Rob was mentioning, called The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler, basically says this, the moguls collaborated with Hitler. They should have known better. They could have stopped the Holocaust. He couldn't have been wrong. They were doing business with Germany because they were in a business, but they were secretly funding the entire operation for until the end of World War II. So without the moguls' support, none of this would have happened.
Even so, I remember in the book you talked about when Leon Lewis went to Jewish organizations and said, we need to do this, they argued with him.
I mean,
and they didn't. They couldn't decide on whether to fund him or not. It wasn't until the moment, which is, you know, in hindsight, we think, how could they not?
Because they were saying, you should do this. No, you should do that. No, you should do this. And again, it was the same thing he had seen through the spring of 1933, that while they were debating what to do about Hitler, Hitler was just moving ahead. And he just got tired of the talk. And he wanted direct money. And he basically, he relied on Irving Thalberg, Rabbi Magnin, and Mendel Silberberg to twist the arms of any mogul who was reluctant to give the money.
Talk about the intersection of the American Nazis and the Christian militia movements and these white Russians. I mean, there seemed to be like this, you know, looking from our vantage point, it just seems kind of unbelievable. But back then, this was the landscape.
Well, in fact, in the mid-30s, all these groups come together and form something called the United Fascist Front. And they wanted to get, this was the Germans, this was the American Silver Shirts, this was the White Russians, and this was a group of White Russians on the extreme right fringe of the White Russian movement. These were the people who wanted the Tsar back in power. And these were the people who also were murdering Jews in Russia. These were, in fact, in the spy reports, Chuck Slocum and Neil Ness talk about how they openly boasted of killing Jews in Russia, of leading the pogroms there. And when they were plotting this with the British fascist McLaughlin, he said, I've already talked to the white Russian leader, George Dambuza, and he said he's got some psycho fellows who love doing this kind of stuff. So they were prepared, and along with them were all these the patriotic groups. So you have, I only put a few in here because it would have jammed up the entire map. I could have put in a dozen more groups here. Not Jewish groups, just the fascists. You've got the California Homesteaders, the American Warriors, the American Nationalist Party, the American White Guardsmen, and then there are all the Christian mobilizers, the National Patriotic Order of Christians, the Minutemen and Minutewomen. There were literally dozens of fascist groups. And these people weren't saying the Jews will not replace us. From 1933 until Pearl Harbor and even afterwards, at least once a month, somebody in this city was openly calling for death to Jews. And I don't mean in their kitchens. I mean at these meetings, these groups.
And what's and so...
And no one is stopping them.
And what's so shocking is that at most of these rallies, I don't know if you have a picture of it here, but I think you do in the book, you have the they co-opted American symbols.
Yes. Well, you've got... I don't have it
in
here.
In other words...
But on the front cover,
next to swastika.
On the front cover of the book, right. The top image here is Hitler's birthday, and there's an American flag and a Nazi flag, and this is 15th and Figueroa. And I did a walking tour of Nazi LA with a friend of mine who's a reporter for the New Yorker, and they did a piece a few weeks ago in Talk of the Town. And we went visiting all these places. This is now the parking lot of the convention center on Figueroa. You'll see if you go in, it's like the driveway into the parking lot. And yes, they always put up the American flags because they claimed they were the patriots. And this is why the LA Times never really denounced them. The LA Times said, oh, they're not a threat at all. It's the communists that are a threat. Because they claimed that they were going to be the vanguard against communism in America, and that one day they said the communists are going to uprise against America and they're going to slaughter all you people, and we're the only thing standing in the way of you in a slaughterhouse. And they claim that's why they were drilling. And in fact, they were. They were drilling in the Hollywood Hills, and they were drilling out in the Palisades. Some of you may have heard about Nazi House or Murphy Ranch out in the Palisades. That was going to be Hitler's Western White House.
And how much do they spend on that?
Millions, tens of millions of dollars.
If you hike there now, you could still see the ruins.
You can still see some of the ruins. If you just Google Nazi House or Murphy Ranch, you'll get a lot of articles and directions. It was going to be 22 bedrooms and a totally self-sustaining compound with their own electrical power plant, their own water plant. Their own meat locker and their own vegetable garden, all surrounded by an electrical fence to keep prying people away. But in the meantime, the Nazis were going there, led by Hans Deibel and others. They were going out on weekly. They had the SS here, their own SS troop. And they were engaging in hand-to-hand combat for the day that there would be an urban uprising, and they were going to take over the city. But they're going to take it over from the communists.
Talk a little bit about George Gisling, the consul general who you've just written about him in the Washington Post, and I think he's such a fascinating character.
Yes, the first reveal was simply the story of the spy network. And by the way, to go back to answer your question, the reason that we don't know about it is they went to their graves. When I interviewed Joe Russo's son, he told me his father never told him anything. They were afraid that Nazis and their families would have long memories and would go after their children. Because at one point, I write about a plot to kidnap Leon Lewis's children. Since they knew Lewis was fearless, they thought if we kidnap his children, he's going to give in to us. But that never happened. But the man, part of the reason L.A. was so important was not just as a port to send in spies, money, and secret orders, but they saw Hollywood as the greatest propaganda machine in the world. And Hitler and Goebbels both loved movies, and apparently Hitler watched a movie every night, loved Hollywood, loved Walt Disney. They shared certain political sensibilities. And he was determined. He felt that had Hollywood not made propaganda films in World War I, that Germany could have gotten a lot more allies amongst other nations and people. So he was determined that no Hollywood movie would come out to denigrate either Germany or Hitler himself. And so he sent this young, relatively young consul, George Gisling, rising star in the Foreign Service, out to Los Angeles in June 1933 with one order: stop Hollywood from making any movie. And the weapon he had was Article 15 from the German import law, that said if any studio makes a film that in some way disparages Germany, that studio will have all its films banned in Germany. And he threatened the moguls, saying not only will you have that film, but all your films, and in fact, if enough of you are going to be delinquent, we will ban all Hollywood films from the German market. Now, the German market was the second largest in Europe, next to Britain, and the largest on the continent. And the moguls, it wasn't so much about collaborating. The moguls just didn't think Hitler was going to last long. And they thought, well, we're going to outlast them. And then Gisling's job got made a lot easier because the next year in July 1934, reacting to a lot of pressure about corruption in Hollywood and Sodom and Gomorrah, they passed the Production Code Administration. And that put into effect one clause that said you cannot make a film that denigrates, attacks, mocks, or in any way ridicules a foreign nation or its leader. And so that meant Hollywood couldn't do anything. And Gisling was going into screening rooms to make sure that nothing went through the cracks. So I wanted to know more about this guy, and so I started reading the social column because I was particularly interested in how would L.A. elites deal with this Nazi. And so I read the L.A. Times, which was the newspaper of record, from 1933 until all German diplomats were expelled in June 1941. And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, this guy is clearly the most popular diplomat in the city. He's the most sophisticated. He's the most cultured. He speaks many languages. And something in my gut, the kind of historian's gut, told me, this guy isn't who he seems to be. And he reminded me of my father-in-law. Why? My father-in-law had been in Germany, had been a medical student, and then was expelled when Hitler expelled all medical Jews from medical school. He went to Padua for a year until Mussolini expelled all the Jews in medical school. And he wound up at Northwestern, where he had the ill fortune of working in the same medical school that where Loyal Davis, Nancy Davis Reagan's father, was one of the major players there, who announced that no Jew will ever get tenure at the Northwestern Medical School while I'm alive. And my father-in-law, Kurt Kent, loved German culture, loved German music, loved German opera, German symphony. And I asked him, how can you do this? And he said, well, basically Hitler was an aberration, and I'm not going to let this man spoil hundreds of years of German culture. That German culture is greater than this monster. And I thought, wait a minute, this guy Gisling, he can't be a real Nazi. And sure enough, I did enough digging and found a 1947 letter to the Nuremberg Tribunal from Brigadier General Julius Klein, a Jew, writing, it starts, this is the only time I will ever write a character reference for a Nazi, because George Gisling is not a Nazi, that from the time he arrived in Los Angeles until he left, he was giving me valuable information about the German economy, about the Bund, and about German war plans. And sure enough, George Gisling was a double agent, not officially, on his own. And I tracked down his daughter, who had been born when he was a consul in New York, and left at the age of 13, went to Germany, and then married after the war, came back to America, then went back to Germany to work for American intelligence, Air Force intelligence, wound up marrying an Air Force officer in the intelligence and moved to Morro Bay. And I tracked her down, went to interview her, and the first thing she said is, I'm so glad you're here because everyone's got it wrong about my father. And what I learned between that letter and my interviewing of her is that he was a German national who hated Hitler, that apparently most of the Foreign Office hated Hitler. They thought he was a clown and that he was destroyed, but he was a dangerous one. I'm talking about the past. That he was a dangerous man and that they were going to do everything they could to subvert him. And, you know, all of a sudden I had hired a researcher in Berlin to go through the files, and he found all these letters from the Bund in L.A. saying, get rid of Gisling. He is not sufficiently anti-Semitic, and he is not sufficiently National Socialist. He will not press. And then I began thinking, I never saw a single spy report of any spy quoting an anti-Semitic statement that Gisling made, and he never did. In fact, his daughter told me, we had no religion. And when I asked my father, well, what religion should I choose? He said, choose whatever you want. You might marry a Muslim one day and convert to Islam.
So we're going to have questions in a moment, but you brought us kind of up to the present day in what you just said. And I just wonder briefly, I want in your words, what do you think the lesson is? What do you think the lesson of for us now is? We live in kind of a difficult time now. And there's something that resonates in this book, deeply resonates.
I think the lesson is when hate groups move from the margins to the mainstream of society, and when our government seems either complacent or complicit, it's time for every one of us as citizens to stand up against this kind of intolerance, to stand up against this kind of hate, and actions small and large. Even if it's, whether it's going to a protest, whether it's hearing someone make a anti-Muslim, an anti-Semitic, a racist statement to say, that's not okay to say that. Whatever it is, if enough people stand up or even take a knee, it will change the culture and it will change the political situation. And these are not heroic men in the sense that they're not born heroes. They're not like Moses born to lead a people. They are ordinary people finding themselves in extraordinary times when they felt the need. And again, these are almost all Christians, and they never saw it as a Jewish or Christian issue. They saw it as an American issue. In the same way, whether it's Charlottesville, whether it's Orlando, whether it's Las Vegas, these are people filled with hate, and our government is not denouncing them. So it's up to us to denounce them. It's up to us to stand up and say enough. That's not what we do in America. That's not who we are as people.
There's a microphone being passed around. We have time for a few questions.
First question.
Thank you. Hey, Rob.
Oh, hi.
It's been a long time, Roxbury Park. Professor, you bring your story up through the 1930s and a little bit into the 40s. Can you talk about, if you did, what happened to these people, the neo-Nazis, the American nationalists, as they went through World War II and then after World War II?
Sure. Well, the interesting thing is when Pearl Harbor comes the next morning, December 8th, the FBI receives a telegram from the Attorney General saying we want the following German, Italian, and Japanese suspects arrested and detained. And there's a long list of names. And I'm thinking to myself, the FBI never had the Bund under investigation. How did they get those names? Guess where they came from? Leon Lewis and Joe Roos, starting in September 1939, the moment World War II broke out, they began compiling lists of every suspicious Nazi in Los Angeles. And then they also had smaller lists of Italians and an even smaller list of Japanese that became a larger list when Roosevelt expelled British diplomats for spying on American soil. But before they left, they gave Lewis and Roos the list of all the spies they had discovered. But what happened is I went to Washington to make sure I was right, and I found in the National Archives that Lewis and Roos had sent a list to G2, Army Intelligence, to the FBI, and to Naval Intelligence. And I found the actual records that the Attorney General used, and it was these long lists of names, and all they had done was retyped the names that Lewis and Roos had sent them, put them in the same categories because Lewis and Roos divided them into the most dangerous, highly suspicious, and keep under surveillance. They simply called them lists A, B, and C, and it was the same names, addresses, and blurbs. So the FBI got all the credit for rapidly rounding up all these Nazis when the real credit belonged to Lewis and Roos. The two main Nazis remained in prison, Hermann Schwinn and Hans Deibel, his lieutenant or captain, whatever you want to call them. They remained in prison until after the war. Deibel never got citizenship, so he was simply deported around 1946. Schwinn had his citizenship revoked. He remained in prison for 5 years and eventually was deported to Argentina, where his wife, an American-born wife, went, yeah, I know, Argentina, amongst his landsmen. But his wife, after apparently a year and a half, his wife didn't like it there, and so she moved back to the States and to Florida, and Schwinn decided, I'd rather be living with my wife. So he moved to Florida, and where did he die? He died in Dade County in 1973, surrounded by one of the most intensely demographic areas of survivors in the United States.
Another question?
I have some inside track on this book, and I know that amongst the spies, there were some women, and I thought maybe you would like to talk a little about those.
Women, yes. You had, starting from John Schmidt's wife, who was fluent in German, she would go initially to the Alt Heidelberg with her husband, and she made herself so invaluable that she was made the president of the women's auxiliary for the Germans, for the Friends of New Germany. And they asked her to translate all their mail, both from German into English and English into German. Yeah, so Lewis got some information, but the other wives were involved because they would invite the Nazis to their home. And one of the things they discovered is you could get a lot more information after 5 or 6 rounds of beer. That many of these men had very loose lips. But the most fascinating story comes at the end, around 1940, when Leon Lewis gets a mother and daughter spy team. That is the widow of a Navy commander. There was only one man in government who absolutely believed Leon Lewis, and that was Commander Ellis Zacharias, who was a rare breed, a Jew who graduated in Annapolis, and apparently had his career stalled for years because he was a Jew, but wound up being the head of naval intelligence on the Pacific coast by 1940. And he knew Lewis was feeding him absolutely accurate information. And so he was the only one Lewis could count on. Well, he was a very close friend of Sylvia and Grace Comfort. They're also on the map, I think. You can see they're under the resistance. The green are some of the resistors. And Neil Ness, one of the other spies up there. And Sylvia, in particular, was one of the most valuable spies he had because she was a stenographer. And any of you who have ever belonged to an organization, when somebody says, who'll take the minutes, and you put your hands down, she volunteered every time. And they knew, because she was a stenographer, they simply asked her. So because she was a stenographer, she got asked to be part of the secret inner circle because Germans liked nothing better than to have records of everything. So she was coming back and telling Leon Lewis everything that was going on. And one of the things that I found remarkable is even after Pearl Harbor, the FBI said, okay, the FBI wrote, case closed on Hermann Schwinn, no more reason to investigate Nazis in L.A., but Leon Lewis knew there were still tons of Nazis and fascists here who had sworn they would, if we got into World War II, they would kill Jews because Jews were the ones who got us in there. And so Sylvia was doing undercover work until finally her life was in so much danger that Joe Roos got a job for her in Washington, D.C. because a number of the fascists said, we know you're working for the Jews. And others said, no, she isn't. But they knew it was just a matter of time until they would discover something that would get her killed. But one of the things she did is write Leon Lewis within months of Pearl Harbor saying, much to my dismay, anti-Semitism has gone up since Pearl Harbor, that I am hearing horrible statements from people who I've never heard make anti-Semitic statements before. And she quoted a meeting of the California Women Republicans Club in which one woman said, there are too many Jews in this city. They're taking jobs away from Christians. We should hang them by lampposts. A second woman said, no, that'll take too long. And a third woman said, let's sterilize them all. And she kept reporting on just vicious, you had vicious anti-Semitism going. So if you think, you know, this whole idea of World War II, the good war, that we recognized Hitler right away, that's false. Until the end of the war, anti-Semitism and support for Hitler was still strong in this city and in this country. I do want to take one moment, though, to acknowledge one person here. Phil, stand up for a second. Gone. This is my colleague, Phil Ethington, who made the map with me. I have the addresses, but he actually did the work of designing the map. Yeah.
Did you see a link between Leni Riefenstahl's propagandistic techniques and filmmaking and Hitler's infatuation with Hollywood?
Yes, because he just felt, again, that Hollywood was, that motion pictures were the most powerful form of political propaganda. And what Hitler said is, you know, people will read, he actually wrote about this in Mein Kampf, people will read stuff and it'll go in and out. But if they see an image, that image stays in their mind. And so Leni Riefenstahl was known as Hitler's filmmaker. He loved her because he loved her the way she look, just like D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, no matter what you think of the politics, it is a brilliant film. It's the first major motion picture that just changes everything in Hollywood. Leni Riefenstahl is perhaps the greatest documentary filmmaker of the 30s and 40s. She is a horrible human being doing horrible things. But as a propagandist, she's very effective. You watch those documentaries, and they are very powerful. And Hitler thought this is how he's going to win the hearts and minds of people around the world. Because remember, they were shipping those films and documentaries to all the pro-German countries around the world, of which in Latin America and Europe, there are quite a few.
Did it screen in Los Angeles?
You know what I... Yes, it would have screened at the... The California Club.
Next door.
And it also screened at, if you look over here, the Continental Theater. That's still around. It's now the Union Theater on, I believe it's Vermont and 28th. You can still see the movie theater. Franz Ferranz, who had the exclusive distribution rights for German newsreels and films, every time he tried to open a movie theater downtown, Leon Lewis went to talk to the landlord. And no landlord would rent it. In fact, Franz brought him to court for defamation and for preventing him from doing business. And the judge threw it out of court. And he eventually found this small movie theater that became the Nazi movie theater in L.A. This is where you went, where you would walk in, and he would be standing in the lobby greeting you with the Heil Hitler. On all the walls were pictures of Hitler in Germany. And they would show movies like The Kosher Slaughterhouse, of which people would then shout out, we should do the same to the Jews, slaughter them all. So this was apparently the one place in the city where Germans felt they could go to watch movies and say whatever the hell they wanted.
My heart is pounding so hard I can hardly talk. When I was in my early teens, like circa 1960, I got very interested about my family history.
What's your question?
My mother, among other things, told me that my grandmother spied on Nazi meetings and took everything down in stenography because she was a terrific stenographer. And I thought that was impossible. I asked my grandmother, and that's the only time, we were very close, that was the only time in her life she would not talk about something. She said she couldn't talk about it. And I thought, she couldn't have been taking down Nazi meetings in Steno. So I thought it just had to be some kind of myth. But I've always wondered, and I wondered if there are any records of the people. Her name wasn't Sylvia, but
yeah,
she was very active with the
there are
the
records for many of the spies. Attorney. And in fact, Neil Ness's wife was caught taking down notes during one of the meetings, and that's when he came under suspicion. They wanted to know, why were you taking those notes? And someone asked at the next meeting to see those notes, and she said, oh, I just threw them out. I gave them to my husband, and he read them, and I threw them out. Hmm. If they would have caught your grandmother, they would have killed her.
I know. That's why I just... Yeah. So my mother
Do we have time for one more question, Louise? One more question.
Boyle Heights had a very activist community during that time. Were people there not aware of Nazi flags and Nazi movies and what was going on?
Yeah, they were aware. They were well aware, but they were probably saying, "What are they going to do? What are they going to do?" Hmm.
Somebody did something, thank God. So thank you very much. Thank you all for coming tonight. And you're going to be signing books outside?
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.